This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not.
Eleanor Savage has made some literary allusions in her debut novel, The Ruiners, where toxic waste in a landfill has echoes of F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Valley of Ashes. So, Eleanor, welcome to 3CR.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
My apologies for that reference to The Great Gatsby, but I couldn't help it. Your novel seems to tap into those notions of excess and waste in everyday society as well as make its own literary allusions.
Absolutely. It's a book about excess and waste being that which we don't use. And so I wanted to write a book about waste where it's filled with all the excess and waste from literature. I want it to be highly referential and just packed full of references.
Well, you're not saying that Dickens is waste, because the first character we come across is Pip.
Yes.
She inherits a manageable sum, shall we say, mm-hmm. that enables her to change the course of her life. And she has great expectations. But does she expose this class anxiety of the industrial age, which is how you portray her?
Well, yes, I would say she has moderate expectations. She's a sort of, as many people in my generation are, a bit of a victim of the housing crisis. She sees her moderate expectations as a chance to flee reality.
But where is she? Where's she working at the moment?
I mean, she's working at a lobster shack. She's an arts degree dropout and an exiled anarchist. And with the 50 grand that she inherits, she's convinced by her boyfriend to buy a trash paradise on a decrepit Greek island.
But just before we get to this Greek island, she speaks to her mother, who has lived in her own bubble of fantasy. Mm-hmm. Who is Pip's mother? What has she done? Pip's the offspring. Where'd she inherit the money from?
The money comes from the deadbeat dad, whom she barely knows. But she's raised by her mother, who is a kind of burnt-out autodidact from Melbourne.
But she's been taken in by Pip's father.
Yes.
In terms of he's from Spain.
And or so he says.
He says. Yes, exactly.
The mother has produced herself according to a set of fantasies. And Pip is exactly the same. Pip hasn't really gotten out of that sort of, she's sort of purposeless. She blames others for her lack of action. And she lives in a world of literary references, basically, and political references. She's built a bubble around her so that she doesn't have to act, because action is very scary, because then if she acted, she would have to be responsible for her actions.
But we've also got this notion of literature in that first section.
Yes.
This threw me into further disarray. Mm-hmm. The critical net hadn't only been drawn over the class societies which condition modern literature, but the globalizing systems of invasion, domination and profiteering. I would never fully comprehend the whole of it. The papers we read to prepare for our tutorials mention not just concepts from literary theory, which were mind-boggling enough, but also facts about 19th century trade networks for cane sugar and iron ore and the theory of surplus value. I mean, what's happened to the study of literature?
I mean, I went to university. It was hard. What I'm talking about there is the kind of endless loops that you can get into, and I was sort of starting to become very critical of literature in the university as a, I don't know that it's the best way to come to appreciate literature. And so what Pip does when she sort of drops out, she realizes that what's happening inside the university, and this is a critique from Horkheimer, actually. I was educated enough to be able to read Horkheimer and critique the university afterwards. But he says that this is a kind of intellectual capital is produced in the university, and it's used to produce the class society. And so when Pip drops out, she sort of realizes that she just actually loves reading, and she loves literature, and she wants to appreciate it. So she says, after she drops out, I continued to read my books and joined an anarchist reading circle, but I read in a haphazard way, with little through line and only the foggiest sense of a broader picture. I was careful to read with the understanding that books were not of themselves catalysts of great and radical social changes, as the publishing monopolies and indeed the small presses insisted, but were instead effects of the societies that produced them, or in the finest, rarest cases, effects that in turn very, very minorly affected their circuits of reception. I credited these effects with their quality of entertaining and comforting me. They kept my mind active through the days of my otherwise stupid life. And this was not nothing. Indeed, sometimes it felt like it was everything. And that's one of the passages where I'm actually speaking, right? Like, it's Pip, but that's how I feel as well.
But enjoying everything. Enjoying literature for literature's
Precisely.
Sake.
Precisely, yeah.
But then, okay, Pip escapes to a Greek island with Sasha, who's her boyfriend, an aspiring academic and writer. But this has echoes of Charmaine Clifton and George Johnson.
What could possibly go wrong?
Exactly. But this. But what do they purchase and where is it?
It's on an island that I made up called Phokos. And the island is sort of, no such island exists in Greece because the islands are very beautiful. But this is an island, well, it is based on a lot of research on the islands that I did, which is at the centre of the island is a huge landfill. And the landfill is contaminating the rest of the island. And this is actually happening on some of the Greek islands because of the surplus waste, you know, problem and the lack of economic, you know, means to kind of deal with it. But I did actually, you know, I just read a long essay about Charmaine Clift. So I was really thinking about Charmaine Clift and George Johnston a lot while I was writing this novel. And just the idea that you think you can escape reality, but you can't, right? It doesn't matter where you go, there you are. And that even the sort of political economic questions that I'm thinking about in this novel, they don't disappear when you move somewhere else. In fact, they might become more visible to you.
Well, it's an integrated economic global world that we have. But this leads into the second section of the novel, which is actually narrated by Vivek. And you've ascribed him with the character of Bartleby the Scrivener, the Herman Melville character, whose key line is, "I would prefer not to." Now, what has happened to Vivek? Why is he on the island?
Vivek is a very, very earnest journalist and editor, and his socialist newspaper, the writers are going on strike because they haven't been paid. And in his earnestness, Vivek decides to go on strike against himself. And this is not going well. And so he comes to the island for some respite. And while he's there, he discovers the landfill and decides this is going to be his great fortune. This is his great expectations. He's going to write an in-depth work of journalism about this and hope to get it published in the New York Times.
There's an interesting irony here because you've got this notion of waste, but the waste on the Greek island, there's this image of a skip at the end of the street. You chuck your waste in it and you don't know where it goes.
Yeah.
But where's the waste coming from on this island?
Right. There's a cartel situation, which is also rooted in research that I was doing for this book. This is happening in every kind of waterway. There are waste cartels dealing with the surplus that we produce, especially in the global north, but everywhere. Governments can't deal with the amount of waste that we produce, and so it's sort of sold off in parcels until eventually it ends up in the hands of waste pirates, garbage pirates who dump, you know, toxic waste in regions of the world where people have very little political purchase. And so Phokos is one of these islands where the refuse is taken and a local, you know, I won't give too much away, but there's some local corruption that is aiding and facilitating these waste cartels.
And yet we sort of chuck our waste out and don't think about the consequences. So we've got this layer now of an economic paralysis in some ways that Vivek is working against. But also then, Vivek is waiting on the arrival of his former partner, Agalos. So what is happening here?
I mean, Agalos, he's in love with Agalos, but he can't sort of, he's sublimating like crazy, Vivek is. He just wants to be good. He wants to get everything right. But it means he basically can't sexually perform. He can't be in a passionate love affair with the man that he loves because he's pouring all of his erotic energy into his political work. And it's making him completely neurotic.
But also, he longs for connection as well. Yeah. Just that simple physical connection.
Love.
And yet all of these forces and political anxieties are preventing it.
Yeah. I wanted to get these characters just at the moment before they have to grow up. And at some point, they're going to have to grow up. And I hope that they do, right? By the end, I give them a chance. We don't know what happens to them after I leave them. But I hope that they're given a chance. And growing up means, to me, it means kind of accepting some of your responsibility for yourself.
But if Pip's
and loving someone, giving yourself to someone.
But if Pip's mother is anything to go by, what chance do we have?
Well, She failed to grow up.
But this then leads into the third section mm-hmm, of the mm-hmm, novel, which mm-hmm. is more of the sexual with Sasha.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is the Book of Exodus. Mm-hmm. So what's Sasha escaping from?
Sasha is an early career researcher with psychopathic tendencies. He's learned from a young age, or so he tells us, how to direct language to produce meaning. And he's extremely insincere. He tells us a story about his refugee origins, and he constructs a narrative that explains his psychopathy, in fact. At a deeper level, he then asks us whether or not we believe him. And so what he's doing is he's a character who, to me, is really the only one who's grounded in reality, or the hell reality that we live in, which is one in which your self-production is key to your survival economically. He's a neoliberal subject. He's an achievement subject. All he wants is success. He doesn't care about love. He doesn't care about honesty. He doesn't care about truth or beauty or political, justice. He cares about getting a job at a university, and that's it.
But he has an ego.
He certainly does.
And seduces women,
yes,
and talks about his prowess.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, you've got to question whether he's actually that successful, because, there's this one...
Because he's self-mythologizing.
So can we trust Sasha and his ambition
Not
and goals?
Not at all. I think that one of the things is that he's... I think the reality to him is that he's sort of... he's in pain and he's vulnerable, actually, and he's built a defense around him, and that's the kind of his mastery of language. The journey that I wanted to send him on was one where he might have to confront his vulnerability and his humanness and his need for love and acceptance. Yeah.
Things don't exactly work out as expected on the island. You've got real estate agents and all sorts of things mm-hmm. coming in there as
lobsters
well. And
coming
lobsters
out of the sea.
And looking rather grotesque.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a coda then to mm-hmm. all of these sections.
Yeah.
And really we get the sense, are they all destined mm-hmm. to repeat the mistakes they made? Because having come together mm-hmm. and broken apart, mm-hmm. they sort of converge again.
They may converge again. We think they're going to converge again. I think the coda was a way for me to really to have the island appraise them in a way, or just sort of have its own logic that was separate from, because these three characters are incredibly self-absorbed. They don't belong, they don't see reality really. I mean, Viv tries to, but he's so neurotic that he's not really connected to it. And so I wanted the island to exist independently of them. But then at the end, allow them to come back and see and interact with the island in maybe a more kind of constructive and meaningful way.
Does it reflect who we are, really, self-delusional in our attitude in terms of what we should be trying to achieve academically, economically, socially, interpersonally?
Yeah. I mean, this is an inheritance novel, right? It's in the tradition of the Victorian inheritance novel, but I'm trying to invert the idea of inheritance from one of personal legacy to one of collective disinheritance. And we need to really appraise the real inheritance is the political economy. It's the piles of garbage that are, poisoning waterways and the soil and the very conditions for life, right?
But it's also we inherit the flaws of the past,
personal flaws,
allow these things to happen.
Of course, yeah. And the sort of ideologies that we accept as ordinary, which can be as toxic as the kind of the leaching piles of garbage.
Well, The Ruiners has us questioning the choices individuals make, the direction of the academic and social institutions in society, and how we all perhaps echo the lives of the literary characters we are alerted to as we go along in this story. So, Eleanor, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, David. What a wonderful reader you are.
Today. And the book is The Ruiners, the author Eleanor Savage, and it is a Simon & Schuster release. Thank you.
And, of course, we don't talk garbage here on Published or Not. You've in fact, been talking to an author of your own, Jan.
Yes, well, your author talked about toxicity, and my author's going to talk about how social media outrage ruined everything.
Here we go.
Ed Koper's last book, Facts and Other Lies, was about fake news. Who makes it, who spreads it, and why? His new book takes on how our emotions are triggered by social media. The book is titled Angertainment. Welcome back, Ed.
Thanks, Jan. Very good to be here.
Social media was initially set up to be just that, social, and connect us. This was to be our happy place. Last year, Mark Zuckerberg reported that only 7% of users' time was viewing content with friends. That makes 93% entertainment and learning about the world. But now, you write, it's becoming one of anger. Why did Facebook engineers set algorithms to follow anger?
Well, it was unintentional. So what they did do is they set out to make social media platforms that keep you engaged for a really long time. And in order to do that, you have to map the algorithm onto human emotions. And unfortunately for us, as a species, our negative emotions are programmed to override our positive emotions. So in other words, if you are scrolling through all these cute puppy videos and then all of a sudden there's a really threatening and scary and piece that makes you really angry, we're programmed to stop and pay attention to that. So if you build an algorithm that maps onto our human systems, you are also building an algorithm that's going to preference all of the angry stuff. And that's exactly what we get now.
So it had nothing to do with generating more revenue for the platforms?
Well, yeah, of course that's behind the motive. But they would be agnostic as to how that revenue is generated. If for some reason we were creatures that wanted to be joyous and happy all the time and that's how they made money, that would work wonderfully for them as well. But unfortunately, the reality is if you want to keep people paying attention, we have these ancient brains that scan all the information we see for threats.
MAGA has a figurehead, Donald Trump, with 10 million thirsty followers on Truth Social and the ability to use bots to manufacture the same effect. Of course, this comes from your book, Angertainment. This is a lot of noise, but there are a lot of issues vying for this attention. How is our attention being hijacked by angertainment?
Well, when we have finite amounts of attention, but infinite amounts of content, the question is what wins that battle for our attention? And unfortunately, it will be the most extreme or contrarian or novel or fringe take on an issue. So if you think about the traditional media ecosystem, like traditional news, they had all these incentives to just service what most people would think. Now, it wasn't always right or wrong, but the incentive was to service what the mainstream opinion is. The opposite is true on social media. The incentive is to serve you information that is more extreme than the next piece of information because you won't see the things that aren't extreme. It's a competition and really it's a race to the bottom. You know, what is the most shocking thing that I can say that no one else is saying that's going to get through?
Another quote from your book, Survival of the Fittest, where the fittest are the most outrage-inducing, over-the-top posts. But you give us an example of just how that is created. You tell us about how you set up a Mexican wave. And it wasn't easy because, you know, you had to build it up before you got that momentum.
This is a perfect metaphor too, because I think when the average person is sitting in a sporting stadium and they partake in a Mexican wave, they do so and notice it at a time where it's sweeping round with thousands of people around them and they just unthinkingly get up, leave their seat and join in and it continues on to the next bay. Now, of course, how does that start? You need one really passionate and persistent idiot who's going to stand there throwing their arms up and down relentlessly and foolishly while nobody else does anything until you do it enough. Maybe one other person joins in who's also equally foolish and then maybe their friends jump up and then you've got a few people and it gets to the point where you have a threshold where everyone looks and says, you know what, I'm going to jump up. That's what is behind a Mexican wave. Now, exactly the same thing happens on social media. When you see some outrage in your feed that everyone's piling on, you don't notice the persistent and passionate effort from some fool that has created that. And that's what they do. And unfortunately for us, there's so many more people out there on social media who are those passionate fools trying to get their Mexican wave started, and they join together, and you have to do that. And the other thing, they have robots to do it. So you don't even need people. You can just create thousands of your own accounts and program them to jump out of their seat and wave their arms in a Mexican wave.
Well, so why are we all joining in, and what are we actually being diverted from?
Well, usually the real solutions to our legitimate grievances, this is the problem. And you can see globally, we see the rise of grievance politicians because social media is great at that. And we're being diverted in all sorts of directions. And some of it's serious, some of it's non-serious. Sometimes the rage bait is, you know, as simple as someone putting a typo in there deliberately, knowing that you're going to correct it. But so often the rage bait is much more serious. It's saying, you know, migrant crime is up, we need to close the borders, or, you know, women have got too much power in society, we need to take back masculinity, and, you know, all these harmful opinions that we see are increasing in society are doing so because that content does really well on social media, and we're programmed as people to get collectively outraged at things.
Well, we used to pay attention to news media, and in the book you sort of say how little content comes actually out of news. News was a believable information source. It set a standard for culture. But now you liken culture and information to pancake batter.
Yeah, we all get this weird mix of all these ingredients in there and all these things that were separate, like eggs and flour. If you think about flour being culture maybe and eggs being news, and we would get our serious policy discussions from people who would never win any talent contests. It's the opposite now. We've folded all that in together, and we have, you know, what the ingredients are indistinguishable, like pancake batter. And so when you're scrolling through your feed, it might be young woman on TikTok doing their makeup while telling you their political opinions. Or it might be, you know, some guy in a podcast studio, you know, smoking a cigar and drinking whiskey telling you his political opinions. And, you know, the pop culture aspect and the political aspect are now completely indistinguishable.
Most attention-seeking kid in school sets the curriculum. That's another comment out of this book, which I thought was great. This brings us to the importance of influencers, like you've mentioned quite a few there. There's some wonderful examples of what you see is not what you get. Now, trad wives, this is sort of traditional wives. Of course, they're at home, they're caring for their husband, they're looking after the children. Let's hear from Angertainment by Ed Coper.
These bread makers are, in fact, the breadwinners. Their domestic life is not a private retreat from being the income earner. It hurts my pretty brain. Leave that to my husband. It is a meticulously staged public content studio designed for mass consumption and monetization. Behind every tradwife's Amish aesthetic and paeans to self-sufficiency is an army of helpers, lights, cameras, and content marketers. These creators are empowered female entrepreneurs, posing as disempowered objects of the male gaze, making a career out of telling women they shouldn't have one.
Look, that is so down to the point. And also you do a wonderful, wonderful example of things in the manosphere. You know, and honestly, to have a young son, it is going to be tricky. It's really
scary.
Going to be
it's scary. And people should know that the net result of the manosphere is that men under 25 have the same opinions on gender as men in their 70s. No disrespect to any men in their 70s listening to this. But, you know, these sorts of things of, you know, a woman's place is in the kitchen. You know, those sorts of attitudes are going backwards. And it's really scary.
There's a lot of American examples. And now I know why Trump wanted cage fighting for his 80th birthday and what rage debating had to do with Charlie Kirk being shot. But here in Australia, we learn about the success of the no vote in the Indigenous Voice to Parliament. Just very succinctly, how did that come about?
Well, what a lot of people didn't see was all of these networks manipulating the algorithms to spread outrage. And it works very well on an issue like the Voice to Parliament because they dredged up all these old grievances that were as old as, you know, the issue itself. But the technology was armies of fake accounts sharing this information relentlessly, these emotive narratives, and introducing a lot of confusion and doubt. And of course, in a referendum, all you need is a little bit of doubt to creep in and people will divert back to the status quo. And that's what we saw.
This is another quote. Angertainment is the art of being uncurated, completely disinhibited and shockingly off script. It works because social media cannot distinguish between positive and negative engagement. Can you see that being used in politics now?
Well, let me think if I can think of any political figures who are completely unfiltered, off script and disinhibited. Yes, in fact, one is the leader of the free world. And these two things are no coincidence. He has cottoned on to the fact that if he says something outrageous and half the people hate it and half the people love it, you've got all the people reacting. And so he knows he doesn't have to be polished. And he knows the UFC fight. He knows that people are going to say, "That's how dare you, desecrating this sacred ground on the White House." And he loves that. And his supporters love that.
I didn't realise he had such a connection with professional wrestling.
He's in the WWE Hall of Fame. He is one of the big figures of professional wrestling. And if you think about professional wrestling, it's such a good analogy for this kind of angertainment. It's everyone suspends their disbelief and cheers the hero, hisses the villain, and watches people break chairs over each other's head. And quite often the baddies in wrestling are the geopolitical enemies of America. You know, you have Iraqis or Iranians, yes, or Russians, yes, or Soviets. And, you know, it's all just the theatre that turns out to be really good, like political theatre now.
In your last book, Ed Koper, Facts and Other Lies, you gave us examples of how we can recognise and rectify disinformation with the acronym ERR, Evaluate, Report, Respond. In this book, you also explained an antidote to angertainment with behaviour, narrative, ideas, culture and ecosystem. What's the acronym for this?
Well, if we want to stop being angry, we have to be nice.
How are some of the ways we can move from being passive consumers to active participants?
Well, there's all sorts of ways, complicated and varied, and there's things we need to do, there's things governments need to do. Of course, we have to fix these platforms. But I think for your listeners, it's really about what can we do as individuals to prevent us being so polarised and divided and at odds with each other all the time. That's what social media creates. Now, there's all sorts of ways that we can prevent that, and they're quite simple. It involves sitting down and talking to people in real life. Shock, horror. Can you imagine? The consensus face-to-face is to find agreement, even with people that we might hate online. So we need to do more of that, and we need to build more empathy, and we need to collectively push our governments to fix these platforms that service anger.
I like the idea you gave about giving health warnings, or the government does it on very many things, and may have to outrage that really exists and disclosure of who is paying for the content and things like that.
Yeah, you see health warning on junk food, because we know that even though it's legal, some ingredients are bad for us and people should know about that. Now, of course, the platforms are geared to service harmful things, and we should know that. And if you had a warning label up the top saying, caution, you know, outrage you see on this platform may appear larger than it actually is in real life, or these platforms are, you know, have been monetized to serve you this content, or, you know, or this creator was paid by, you know, Pauline Hanson to say something nice about her, whatever it is, you know, that transparency would go a long way.
Yeah. Now, we're running out of time, but teach media literacy is really also important too. As author Ed Koper writes, if you don't want to live in a world of angry, racist trolls, manufactured culture war outrage and authoritarian destruction, you should read his book, Angertainment. And I did, and I learnt a lot. Thank you very much, Ed.
Thanks so much, Jen.
You've just been listening to Published or Not on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.